Colonel Kitson Montgomery, Reel 4. Colonel, you were saying about the problems of having to dig out the armoured car fairly regularly.
Yes, well, one had to dig. And, during the war, the Humber and the Daimler, one didn't have to dig nearly so much. They were better adapted. And, of course, the other thing was, with the rails in particular, and with the other vehicles later on, they boiled like hell, as you can imagine. Funny enough, they didn't, one would expected them to have worn out clutches very quickly, but their old rails didn't. And we didn't have very much clutch trouble, which one would have thought, you know, this continual... And, of course, one got to know what was good going and which was bad. That was one of the things the troop leader had to do on these occasions. He always went in front in this particular context, naturally. And he had to pick the good going and the bad going. And one got to know what was good going and which was bad going. But in different parts of the desert, when it was black, generally the going was good, but in certain parts of the desert it was absolutely lethal. And when you got very, very light sifting sand, you knew that it was generally bad. Occasionally you found it was just a little bit of sifting sand over the pebbles, and it was good going. So it wasn't altogether easy. That's really why one got stuck. But you could tell roughly which was the good going, which was the bad. And then just before the war, I believe the LRDG had some wonderful maps on the Guide Pendergast, of which we had, of course, given to us later on, which was good going and which was bad. The Western Desert, because they used to go out there a tremendous lot. Pip Roberts and Guy and other people.
You mentioned there that the troop leader went off ahead. Was that the general's pattern in training?
No, not in training, no. No, no. No, no, never. Not in training, but this was merely and simply when one was going from A to B and getting experience of the desert. Like this troop leader. No, under normal circumstances, the corporal, or generally the corporal was first. The troop leader was the second vehicle. And the sergeant the back, and then you swapped it round. Then the troop leader on certain occasions, my orders were when I commanded in the war, that would be the order and they could swap it round. But on certain occasions, the troop leader could go in front and would go in front, but only in the... when it was a necessity, when things got difficult, then the troop leader could get out of it or go into it straight away. If he suddenly came face to face, which one officer did, with 288s, and he went tally well straight in front, and got him. That chap's, I won't go into that, but he's a great chap. He's just he was my adjutant. He's just a retired general. He retired about... 6 weeks ago, General Brockbank. He was a subaltern in the war, and he was a very, very able chap, a very brave man, very good officer. But on that occasion, he went, and quite rightly, he went in front and got away. He was shot up, and he broke his leg and that sort of thing, and got out. But it's a long story.
But in your training in the 30s, that was a normal thing for you to be behind the corporal?
Or the troop, yes, the sergeant, yes. But on occasions, when it was necessary, you went in front. But the principle was that you didn't. Until you probably found the enemy, then probably you could go in front. It was probably wiser occasionally. I mean, it was left up to you, and I had the same principle as commanding officer. But when you first bumped it, you didn't want the officer to bump it and be bumped off, because he had to find out what was really there. And if somebody was under fire, and anyway, if he's under fire and tucked himself in, he probably wasn't in the position to see. The chap behind was in the position to have a look and see where the enemy were and about it.
When you did your training in manoeuvres in the desert, what sort of role were you assigned in the cavalry?
You mean as armoured cars?
Yes.
Well, chiefly we went in front to find out the enemy position by, if necessary, by force. If not, find out and report back. I mean, if you could overrun the enemy up to a point, it was a very good thing. On the other hand, one didn't want to go into the into those days any sort of anti-tank weapon, which there wasn't very much, of course. Anti-tank rifles are the only thing.
Did you do many of these maneuvers?
Oh, we did once a year, one almost did it. The whole army did it once a year.
Do you have any memories, or do you remember doing this?
Well, I remember doing it. As I remember on one occasion when we were put, we were sent, Colonel Holmer was commanding, and I was in the in the role of liaison officer between him and brigade. He found the enemy. Of course, he got wild. He particularly sent back to Brigadier Brooke, who was commanding the brigade, to tell him on their account the committee's reserve, because he thought he was only met the enemy's screen, but not in force. And when we got back, I reported this, and I think Brigadier Brooke had already committed himself. Anyway, Major Beddington afterwards, General Beddington, was his brigade major. And that moment, a Royal Tank Regiment NCO, driving a three-ton lorry, had come up from the bottom and said he wanted to see the general. And luckily, he met one of the officers who produced him. And he said, the enemy are right round your flank down the bottom. And he said, there are thousands of them. And this was Monty, commanding the brigade, who, although he was only a lieutenant colonel, he'd been given the brigade to command. And he'd outflanked him. And General Brooke thought he hadn't got any reserves, and I can remember Major Beddington saying, oh, I'm sorry, Brigadier, I didn't, you still have, I didn't commit them. You've got the 1721st Lancers, and they've got their machine guns all waiting. And it was an absolute fluke, and of course, Monty's brilliant strategic thing, it worked, but it didn't work as well as it should have done. Thanks to this Royal Tank Regiment driver. I do remember that.
You were mainly a reconnaissance role, though, and that was
mainly a reconnaissance. Reconnaissance in force was, I think, what you could have called it. And of course, but from the internal security things and that sort of thing, we were not reconnaissance. I mean, we had a definite job to do, and that was a fighting job.
What exercises did you do without any troops at all?
Oh, we did quite a lot of them on tactical exercise without troops on models and on sand tables and things like that. We used to have to do that. There was always a bit of a complaint because the 12th Lancers always had we had so many holidays. The commanding officer wouldn't give us a full holiday on a Thursday or whatever the day was. And we had to work up, and we generally did a tactical exercise, not about once a fortnight, certainly, during this morning, while all the other regiments were having a nice holiday and the wives bathing and things at Heliopolis swimming baths. I can remember various swimming baths, I remember. And 12th were always working, and the wives had to go without their husbands. They always complained. It was a very good team because we worked rather harder than some regiments, and it paid off at Dunkirk and Lathley, too.
You'd say you worked harder then than you were doing with horses, you know, previously.
I don't know. One had tremendous long hours with horses because one had stables. I thought one had longer hours with horses in a way, except that I can't remember whether about the holidays in the, at that early period of the horse time, whether we had them or whether we didn't. But I remember, and certainly in Colonel Hornby's days and Colonel McCrary's day, we certainly had to work that extra morning.
Was there during this period, would you say, any particular officers who concerned themselves with the sort of theoretical work
of tactics?
The theoretical work of tactics and things. Were there any particular officers who were known for that or working?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, that was one of the things, we all had to do it. But, I mean, it was generally a regimental exercise set by the commanding officer. Not always. Sometimes the squadron leader had one. But we had quite a lot of that.
Did you, in those exercises during this period, work with the Air Force at all?
Not really at that period. I could have, was allowed to have called for an Air Force plane if I got into serious trouble when I went to Air Force. We used to all go up with flights with the Air Force. We used to go there, and then the Air Force had to teach us how to swing compasses. I remember doing a course at compass swinging, because we had to have the compass on the armored car, and the compass swinging was a very complicated thing because of adjusting your compass on the vehicle to all the armor and things like that. And I went, we all went on a course, at least I certainly went on a course on there. And but we had some very good cooperation with the Air Force and the war. At least I didn't so much. I had officer, Air Force officer up with me. But I'm now divert. One of the things I got in my thing about this was I can remember after the breakthrough at Merritt, we came round and the 8th Armoured Brigade, which were attached to the New Zealand Division, had to force the line. And the Staffordshire Yeomanry, under Colonel Eadie, who was now dead, who was a very able amateur officer, but very good indeed, he had got, and I was there at the time, and he got Air Force Squadron Leader in his tank. And a squadron, this particular squadron, was shooting up with anti-armored vehicles, the German tanks at 1,200 yards. And he got a set. He was in the next door tank, the squadron leader. And he was, and they put up various smoke. And he made them do a dummy run, and they got away with that. And they came in, and they fairly laced, and they had about 11 tanks. Knocked out about 11 German tanks, wallop, and it was a most beautiful thing. And say next time they did it once more. I'm sure they did it with other. Did it once more. He said, "Well, I'm rather well going to lead, and one of the flight officers can come into the tank." But there was tremendous cooperation like that. He was actually on the ground with his squadron in the air, and it worked. And that's one of the reasons we worked through. And then as soon as they went up in flames, Staffordshire went straight in, which they'd had a hell of a lot of casualties. But the Germans were very definitely, their morale was very shaken. And we got our objective and broke through the line. But there was tremendous, and another time, I was sent right round the German flank when we were advancing between El Alamein and Benghazi, and I had to capture Martuba aerodromes, go 500 miles right round. And when we were advancing, the other brigade was coming up. General Lomason was commanding at the time. He gave me I had a hurricane which landed alongside me every 3 hours to tell me where the Germans were, because I was armored cars. I got an enormous column of soft vehicles with me to carry my petrol. And we wanted to know where the German tanks were, because they were not. And this chap, this aeroplane, we had a different one each day, and he would tell me, "Well, exactly 20 miles away, still going on this. Tell them you're all right now." And I was just below them, going like hell. They did wonderful landings. We just found a place on the ground, middle of the desert. He'd swing around, and we put a couple of flares, and down he'd come and give me the information. They were awfully good, the Air Force, like that. And so the cooperation got better and better as time went on. But we got on with the Air Force very well. We had this Army Support Squadron at Heliopolis who worked in, they were mostly with GHQ, but it worked in very well.
And you'd say that started in that period in the 30s, would you?
It began in the 30s, yes. And it began in the 30s and went on.
Say the big manoeuvre that you mentioned. Did that involve Air Force?
Yes, a bit. But there was very little Air Force. Can you stop it? I've got to go.
You were saying, Colonel, about cooperation with the Air Force. Did you have, when you went on this training for use of compass and things, did you have problems in direction, finding your way in the desert?
Oh, yes. You had those who were good and those who were bad. And, oh, yes, it was a tremendous problem because... first of all, one's compass was terribly affected. And, in fact, particularly in the war, your stacking of ammunition made a deal of a difference. And I myself used to be quite honest, one had all these, and you could shoot the other lights, although I couldn't do it, but you had a chap who could do that, not in the regiment, but you occasionally give him one, but divisional headquarters, and do all these sort of things, sun compasses, which I never thought were very good, and I found the good old oil compass, provided you got in a certain position, and you set it each morning, because you went away and you got your true north, and there was a difference probably of 7 or 8 degrees on your vehicle, because of the armour and because of the ammunition and things like that. But if you sat on the top, you could work it out. I had because I always remember that General Lumsden sent me on this thing from the Tubular Aerodrome. He said, well, you've got to go through a minefield, which is 250 miles from here, and there's one gap. I said, well, he said, you've got the best navigator in the world, which is my second command, Major Palmer, Rodney Palmer, which is Colonel Rodney Palmer. And he entirely navigated by his ordinary compass, his oil compass. He worked out a lot of things each day, and he got them and he didn't move. And, by God, 250 miles, he found this gap, we hit it absolutely straight. Hit the gap, which is 100 yards wide. And that for navigation is quite incredible. And he was a wonderful navigator. I was never very good, but I could navigate. But, I mean, not that sort of standard. But navigation was a very, very important part.
In these sort of exercises in the 30s, were there any incidents where people got lost or...
Oh, yes, particularly dispatch riders. Oh, God. And then one fellow got lost for 4 days. He had terrible trouble. And said, Corporal Brown, I always remember. Couldn't pronounce his R's. But, no, not many people, but the odd person got lost. Because they didn't have the necessary aids. I mean, that was one of their troubles. They didn't have necessary compasses. It was then the troop leaders who had the compass. Unless, I mean, toward the end, of course, the sergeants managed to get compasses and things like that. But quite frankly, the navigation was always done by the 99 cases out of 100 was done by the officers. One troop sergeant, I suppose. He could do it perfectly well, but, you know, that was one of the things. And it was very important, of course, to arrive at the right place at the right time.
On these exercises, particularly, say, on the manoeuvres, in terms of communication, how did you keep in touch with your brigade headquarters?
Oh, that was by wireless. The regimental headquarters, brigade headquarters, this is the beginning. But from troops to squadron, entirely by dispatch rider, or occasionally an Austin 7. Fellow on a motorbike, or we had an Austin 7th. One of the troop leaders might be made a liaison officer. But, well, no, not from troop to squadron, but from squadron to regiment. And from squadron to regiment, rear link, there was a wireless set. And of course, later on, we all had wireless sets, and everybody had a wireless set. I can't remember whether at Dunkirk they did, but certainly in the County London, which I was in, each tank had one. And that was always rather difficult because you had everybody on the same net. In a regiment, each squadron had its different net, so that you didn't get interference. But the interesting thing was in the desert that and after about 7 o'clock at night. The atmospheric got worse and worse and worse. And by 9 o'clock, unless you were close, you really couldn't talk. You had to send it out by Morse. When fighting, my squadron might be 25 miles away, you see, and when we were advancing like that. I mean, I might have a squadron 25 miles out here and 25 miles out here. I was probably in the middle. It was only about 8 to 10 miles. That was all right. But If I couldn't get my orders for next day out by 8 o'clock, he generally had to go in Mawson and met the wretched operators having to work all night in code. He had to go out in code, you see. And that was one of the difficulties. In tanks, it was okay, perfectly all right, because you were always worked terribly close together. I mean, you were never, unless one was detached, when you were fighting as a tank unit, you were probably never more than a couple of miles away from your flank squadron. So there was no... And then you came into Liga at night, 9 cases out of 10. Occasionally you had to stay up, but 9 cases out of 10 in the desert. And therefore you were all together at night, so you didn't have that problem.
On the manoeuvres you did, how long would they last?
Oh, 4 days, 3 or 4 days. Yeah. The final manoeuvre. Regimental ones. Well, regimental ones might do 2 or 3 days. It depended what... where you were, what part of the world you were in. And then how much you were allowed, and where petrol and things, how much the government allowed you. When things were stringent and that sort of thing, you were cut down in petrol. Not very often.
And afterwards, would you have a kind of post-mortem?
Oh, always a conference. Always. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. When you were given a stick or congratulated one or the other. Oh, always a conference. I mean, that all took time, you see. You had a conference when you came back.
What sort of state would you say people like Colonel Hornby felt the regiment was in at this
Colonel
period?
Oh, always first class. We always had, I don't think we ever had anything but the top reports.
Now, you were a long time in Egypt. You didn't go to India, did you?
No, we didn't, no.
Why was that?
Because, for some unknown reason, the Indian government wouldn't have any armoured cars, and the Royal Tank Regiment kept their armoured car company in Egypt, and they said they only wanted one in India, and they only wanted one armoured car company in the whole of India, which they had in the northwest frontier. And so they wouldn't have a regiment, so that we never went, and we should have gone instead of the Royals, and the Royals went a year earlier as this cavalry. And we stayed in Egypt. And of course, but you see, we were being mechanized, and it'd been very difficult to have got us much more to get us back from India to all these courses to mechanize us in India than it would have been to mechanize us in Egypt. And then when we were fully mechanized, I don't suppose they wanted us, but I mean, that was a war office set up. I wouldn't really know that.
What would be the state of morale then in the regiment as a result of having to stay such a long time in one place?
Oh, we all loved Egypt. Everybody enjoyed it. Well, people were well looked after, and we had plenty of cheap or cheapish things. I mean, we had our polo, we had our shooting, our racing from the Canada side, and then I used to play cricket, and they played squash, swimming. You had everything. And a lovely climate, except in the summer. And I didn't mind the heat. And then you got a tremendous leave from Egypt. I mean, it was ridiculous. I think you got 3 months a year, which, of course, included travelling backwards and forwards. You didn't travel by aeroplane, you went by boat. That took a fortnight off you, anyway.
You came back to England?
You came back, well, you used to come in. I once went abroad. Went to Europe, but otherwise I was to come back to England. Some of the people used to go and hunt big game down in Sudan and things like that. They used to take their leave. Mostly you went back to England. You got about 2 months in England.
And did you mix socially with other arms, you know, in the...
Oh, yes, you had your mess nights and that sort of thing, oh, yes. And... In your games, you came across them. I mean, our brigade was 3 other cavalry regiments, Royal Horse Artillery Regiment, and then there was a Brigade of Guards battalion. There was a battalion at Abbasia, battalion at Alexandria, and 2 battalions down on the Suez Canal. Funnily enough, those 2 battalions, we didn't, merely and simply because strategically, you got to Alexander by train, and you had to. It was much more difficult to get them. So we didn't see those. What was the Canal Brigade? There were three, I think, called the Canal Brigade. We didn't see much of them, but the Alexander battalions, because we used to go up there to play polo, and also for weekends in the hot weather. And we often stayed, particularly with the Durham Light Infantry. We stayed in their messes and that sort of thing. Joined for two or three days. And if they came down to Carr, they might, to play polo or to play cricket or something like that, they might come and stay in our mess. Oh, yes, it meant a lot of cooperation between the other arms.
One question I didn't ask you right about the beginning of the mechanisation. Was there some sort of any formal ceremonies when you lost your horses? Did you have a kind of parade out and all the rest of it?
I think we did, yes. First squadron, I'm sure we did. I can't remember it, but I got it back in my mind there was one. Now there's...
Yeah. When you returned to England, you came to Tidworth. What sort of training were you doing there?
Well, the same sort of training in a slightly different way, because one was much more confined to Salisbury Plain. But one did quite a lot of training on the roads, which one, of course, couldn't do now. Exactly the same sort of training as in Egypt, but not so, not nearly so wide, and one wasn't left on one's own nearly quite so much. But it was very similar. Probably we got rather more courses and things like that. But and of course the training for in closed country was slightly different to training in the wide open spaces, if you understand what I mean.
What sort of things were you doing, in fact?
Oh, well, it was all roads, you see, except on Salisbury Plain. We did a lot of road. And round here, when there weren't many signposts, you always used to send people into the chute area to go and get lost, and they always did. Luckily, I knew it, so that was all right, because I lived here.
Did you take part in the tank brigade exercises and the exercises on Salisbury Plain?
Yes, but I cannot remember. I'm sure we did.